Listener supported. WNYC Studios.
Hi, everybody. Welcome to All of It. I'm Allison Stewart. Today is the day that we here at the station have been discussing for months. Midterm elections are upon us, and for some of you, that might mean you're feeling stressed. Very stressed. This show is dedicated to you. In fact, some people have even called the anxiety that gripped the nation in the wake of the 2016 election post-election stress disorder. While it isn't technically a disorder, the post-election stress is a real thing. Our guest, Thomas G. Plant, PhD, is a psychology professor at Santa Clara University and an adjunct clinical professor of psychiatry and behavioral sciences at Stanford University School of Medicine. He published an article in Psychology Today titled Post-Election Stress Disorder, Is It a Thing? Professor Plant, welcome to All of It.
Well, thank you for inviting me. It's great to be with you.
We do want to hear from you, our listeners, over the next 2 hours. We're keeping the phone lines open. Are you anxious about today's elections? Have been losing sleep over it? Give us a call with your tips or your questions on how to combat election stress. Our number is 212-433-9692, 212-433-WNYC, or you can tweet at us at All of It WNYC. So, Professor Plant, you wrote an article describing about how America's stress levels were the highest they've been in a decade post-election. How long has the American Psychological Association been conducting their Stress in America test?
They have been doing this for about 15 years or so, and every year they do a very comprehensive, thorough job at looking at stress in America. And in the most recent surveys, which one was put out just last week, and then the one that I was referring to in that Psych Today article was after the 2016 election, they found that stress in America has never been higher as far as they've been doing these studies, and they found that politics is the number one reason our nation's future and politics and also so forth is the number one reason why people are feeling stressed, even more so than personal problems and work troubles.
The study found that more Democrats were experiencing stress about politics than Republicans, but it also found that a majority of people from both parties were stressed about the future of the country. What kind of thinking contributes to this kind of stress?
Well, it's, people have been very absorbed by politics, as you know, of late, and it's kind of hard not to, given how divisive it is and how we are on a 24-hour news cycle, and you can't sort of escape it. And so people are going to absorb it. And things are remarkably divisive, and people have strong feelings. It almost feels like we're moving towards another civil war, if you will, with red states versus blue states. And so you can't help but absorb it.
We want to hear from our listeners how you're coping with the stress of the midterm elections and post-2016 election. Maybe you're a Democrat who's curious and hoping for the blue wave. Maybe you're a Republican who's really liked having the White House, Senate, and the House on your corner and are concerned about the House flipping. We do want to hear how you're coping with your election stress and your post-election stress. Our number is 212-433-9692. 212-433-WNYC, or you can tweet us at All of It WNYC. We're talking to Thomas G. Plant, PhD. He's a professor of psychology. And all right, so you have this blog on Psychology Today called Do the Right Thing, Spirit, Science, and Health. And you are really concerned about how all of this American anxiety is turning into despondency. Can you clarify the difference between despondency versus anxiety?
Oh, sure. Yeah, I mean, I think for certainly anxiety, people are stressed out, they're anxious, they're talking about having a hard time sleeping, they're talking about having a hard time pulling away from all these media reports about all the shenanigans in our politics and so forth. And that's different than despondency in terms of where people get stressed out, they develop what we might call learned helplessness or depression, and they just kind of give up. And they'll say, oh, I just can't handle it anymore. And so it's sort of chronic anxiety and stress ultimately turns into learned helplessness and despondency, where folks feel almost numb to it all. And that's not a good way to be either, because one of the concerns on a day like today, Election Day, is that those who may feel particularly despondent and numb may not actually go out and vote and do something proactive to try to help their situation.
We've been talking about the emotional effects of stress. What are some of the physical side effects of stress?
Well, you know, there's a lot of physical unintended consequences. People aren't sleeping so well. People are more likely to drink more alcohol. I did an interview yesterday on this topic with a radio station in Los Angeles, and the interviewer was concluded the interview saying that he needed a good stiff drink, and I think a lot of people feel that way. So some of the physical outcomes would include, you know, chronic anxiety, stress, elevated heart rate and blood pressure. Perhaps maladaptive coping styles like eating too much, drinking too much, not getting adequate sleep, maybe being irritable with those around you. And so there's a variety of biological, psychological, social, or what we often call just biopsychosocial factors that are going to contribute to dealing with stress.
Let's take a couple of calls. We've got Robbie in Manhattan on line one. Hi, Robbie.
Hello. I want to tell you, I have just voted. I'm in the Upper East Side. I've been voting in the same school around the corner for 40 years. Waited outside in the rain and the pouring and for 35 minutes before I got inside. We waited inside for another 20 minutes before we could get. Anyway, the point I want to make is several people were there with children, a child or children, and any time I got near someone with a child or children, I complimented them for exposing their children to democracy and what it means in an election, and explained to them how nice that in this election today, what an election means in a democracy is the person who gets the most votes is the one who wins. And I said, of course, that doesn't always happen. And each time, I've said this to at least six different parents in line with children or child, they smiled and said, yes, I know what you mean. I said, does your kid understand that? Oh, yes. Yes, he knows exactly what happened before. And yes, he knows that in a democracy, the person who gets the most votes is the one who wins. So this relieved my stress a little bit. And when I left, there were still pouring outside, puddles, umbrellas, strollers, people with kids. And as I left with my sticker, my polling place, they give you a little sticker, I have voted, and that's on my coat. And again, in the line, lined up there in this rainy, rainy, puddly day, each person with a child or children, I said this to, it relieved my stress, and I think it relieved them. They thanked me, and they said, oh, yes, I've explained that to my kid. Yeah, what happened before? Oh, boy. Well, so I thought I would let anybody else know who's going to vote, hasn't voted yet. If you see someone with children, compliment them for taking their children and letting their children know that in most votes in our country and any place else, the one who wins the most votes is the one who wins.
Robbie, thank you so much for calling. We've gone to Donald in Jersey City. Hi, Donald. Hey, Donald, how are you coping?
Well, my gripe is that Donald Trump is a very effective communicator. So I think the main thing with his wallpaper approach to communication is to tune it out. In other words, don't listen to him too much, because if you find him offensive, it's only going to make you more stressed if you listen to him too much.
All right, Donald, thank you so much. We want to go to one more call. Elizabeth in Yorktown Heights. Hi, Elizabeth.
Hi. My comment is just that I myself and many of my friends and family definitely experienced post-traumatic depression and anxiety after the 2016 election, for sure. And I can definitely sense that people are anxious this time around too. But I think it's really important that we not throw around this term disorder attached to that, because disorder implies that this is about you and it's something wrong with your constitution, with your chemical makeup, and something wrong inside you. When these are just real phenomena, these are just things that are happening outside in our world that we're responding to emotionally and, you know, as a collective. And to use the word disorder regarding that is just making it that it's our fault and our problem and we have to solve it within ourselves. And it just creates a market for drugs. And that has nothing to do with, you know, how we should go about solving, you know, the things that are causing our anxiety and our depression.
Elizabeth, thank you so much for calling. You're listening to All of It on WNYC. We're talking about people who have post-election stress or experiencing stress today. If you want to share your story or how you're coping with your stress, 212-433-9692, 212-433-WNYC is our phone number. We have Thomas Plant on the phone. He's a professor of psychology at Stanford University School of Medicine, an adjunct professor, as well as a professor at Santa Clara University. Professor Plant, it was interesting. I thought it was interesting what that woman, Robbie, said about talking to children, and that made her feel better about the future. Is part of this about knowing what can happen? I mean, the uncertainty of it all, she seemed to find some sort of solace in the idea that, well, the kids will save us.
Yeah, that Robbie's story is a beautiful story because it speaks to how, as she's waiting in line on a, you know, rainy day in New York, that she notices the children and she's complimenting. And in some respects, I think what she was saying at maybe 30,000 feet up is we're all in this together. Old, young, moms and dads, little kids, we're all in this together. And the more that we can embrace that, perhaps the better, we can say, you know, we're all trying to do something to make our community better for the common good. And the more that we can feel that the old and the young, the stranger and the friend and so forth, people just waiting in line, can we kind of connect? Can we compliment one another? Can we chat? Can we complain about the weather? But can we also say, yes, we are in this together. We're doing our part. We want to make our country better. And so I think Robbie's story is a beautiful one.
I want to ask you a question about this because this has been a big discussion in political circles about civility versus incivility. And, you know, like you said, we should be together. We should be talking about to each other about our problems. But there's a lot of people who say, you know what, being civil is causing me stress. I want to go out and do something. I want to fight. We can't be civil at this point. I would love to hear your thoughts about civility and mental health.
Well, thank you. And, you know, it's kind of funny you mention it because I do a lot of work in the civility area, and I'm a, quote, civility ambassador for the American Psychological Association. And so I talk about the three C's of public and political discourse. The first is civility. That you can never get anywhere with anyone in terms of changing people's mind or having a debate and so forth unless you are civil. So I think this whole notion of civility is critically important. And that we all need to strive towards civility. The second C of my three C's is compassion. We have to try to understand others, even those we don't like or don't agree with, to try to understand their point of view, try to approach them with a certain degree of humility to try to get a better appreciation for what they have to say and what they believe. And then the third is the common good. Back to Robbie's comment and story about, you know, we're all in this together, young, old, and so forth. And so, I think civility is critical, and that, as Michelle Obama had said during the election cycle in 2016, when others go low, we go high. And I think that's a good mantra. I think being civil, even when people are not civil to you, is important because we need to model civility wherever we are.
Let's go to Vivian in Sussex County, New Jersey. Hi, Vivian.
Actually, I'm in Suffolk County, Long Island.
Oh. Sorry, it says New Jersey on my screen. Long Island's good, too.
There is. And the other day I heard someone on your show, one of the commentators, saying that he didn't think that that the Democrats were going to be successful there. And I have seen people here who have coped with the stress of the 2016 election, not by despondency, but by activism. Hmm. There have been groups that have just, the Indivisible group, just flourished in Suffolk County. And I truly believe with the turnout we've been seeing, with the numbers that we saw in the primaries and early voting, that we are going to win CD1 and CD2, both of them, in Long Island, and that we will see a new person in place of Peter King, we will have Luba Gretchen Shirley, and in place of Lee Zeldin, we'll have Perry Gershon, because of the activism. That we're not being despondent. We're stressed, but we're working. It's been motivating.
Vivian, thank you so much for calling and for listening. Let's go to Aaron in Brooklyn on line 6. Hi, Aaron.
Hey, how are you? Thanks for taking my call.
Of course. How are you coping?
I'm coping exactly like Vivian said. I am getting out. I'm volunteering as much as I can. I'm turning my nervousness and anxiety into just a powerful battle cry with my friends. We've volunteered for numerous campaigns. We put our money where our mouth is, and we are taking to the streets.
All right, Erin, thank you so much. Professor, you have, I know you work a lot with prayer and with faith when it comes mm-hmm. to people who find themselves in difficult, stressful situations. Can you just discuss a little bit with us about the power of faith in times like these?
Sure. We believe that that the research suggests that faith, prayer, has a variety of advantages when it comes to helping people to kind of quiet their mind, organize and center themselves, remind themselves that they're part of something bigger, maybe more important than themselves. And so, and people feel connected when they pray, both individually, but also in community. And so the faith traditions can offer a variety of ways to engage in prayer, meditation, community support, and so forth. And that feeling that you're part of something bigger and larger and perhaps more important. And it does help people organize and center themselves when it comes to certain key values. And that can be very productive and useful.
Let's check in with Staten Island. I believe Jerry is from Staten Island on line one. Hi, Jerry.
Hi, how are you?
I'm doing well. How
Thanks
are you today is the question.
Well, I'm stressed, but as I told the screener, every time I vote, I remember the first time I was in a voting booth in 1956 when my mother took me with her. I wasn't in school yet. She made me stay outside the voting booth because she said voting is a private matter. But every time I vote, I think about being part of generations of my family that have always voted in every election, generations of Americans. This is a dark moment, but it's happening in a historical tradition. It will be better.
Jerry, thank you so much. Professor Plant, before I let you go, our next segment is about meditation apps. A lot of people are turning to meditation in these times. Can you tell us a little bit about some of the science behind meditation and why it's effective?
Yeah, sure. There's a great deal of research, particularly most in recent years, about meditation. A lot of people have heard about mindfulness-based stress reduction, mindfulness meditation. That's one very, very popular approach, but it's only one of many. There are many different meditative approaches that all the spiritual, religious, and traditions have offered. In the Christian tradition, there is what's called centering prayer, which was developed or particularly highlighted by Thomas Keaton, who just passed away a couple weeks ago, who's a Trappist monk, as well as Thomas Merton. And the science basically suggests that when you do randomized trials on meditation, it tends to be very, very helpful in a variety of ways, giving people a sense of calm, peace, lowers blood pressure. It helps them feel more organized and centered, connected to something larger. And of course, different kinds of meditative approaches can not only involve these quieting of approaches like mindfulness or something like that, but also active ones too. Believe it or not, very like drumming and even things like snake handling, believe it or not, can be
what?
Considered snake handling. Yeah, in some traditions, they engage in things like fire walking and snake handling and so forth. I wouldn't recommend it because people get hurt, but that's a very active kind of contemplative practice. So the research thus far seems to be very favorable for meditative approaches for helping people cope with and manage stress. But what's important is that for folks to find the strategies that work best for them, given who they are and what they're interested in and their whatever tradition they may come from or they gravitate towards. And while mindfulness gets a lot of press, which is terrific, there are many to choose from.
And I was going to let you go, but we do have one question for you, and I want to get to it. The caller is from Mount Vernon, New York. Hi, how do you pronounce your name?
Agri, A-G-G-R-E-Y.
Okay, what's your question?
My question was, the bank, I voted early this morning, and when I go to the bank, the lady made me wait, so I was getting all worked up. And I said, no, calm down. Really, calm down and let her calm down. By the end, she was calm, I was calm, so my question was, What happened? I don't know what happened.
Why did voting, Professor, any ideas why voting calmed him down?
Well, you know, a lot of people, and one of your earlier callers, I think it was Aaron, had said something about, you know, or Vivian, I think, Vivian had said something about, you know, you feeling empowered, getting out there, doing something. And so a lot of anxiety is anticipatory anxiety. People kind of are worked up as they think about stuff, but when they actually can engage in active coping, they're going to do something specific, like go and vote and wait in line and pull the lever or fill out the Scantron or whatever the thing is, then it helps to channel their anxieties in a way that they feel is productive, that's going to result in a better outcome. And so the actual engagement in active coping, like going out there and voting or canvassing and so forth, may actually help kind of organize, center, and calm someone down in a productive way.
Thomas Plant is a psychology professor at Santa Clara University and an adjunct clinical professor of psychiatry and behavioral sciences at Stanford University School of Medicine. Thank you very much, Professor Plant, for joining us today.
Well, thank you for your gracious invitation. It was wonderful to be with you, and I hope everybody out there who's listening goes out there and vote.
Coming up next on All of It, we'll learn about some of the apps out there marketed to help you unplug and relieve stress. How effective are they if they require you to log into your phone? Stick with us. All of It will be back after the break. Welcome back to All of It. I'm Allison Stewart, and I have a question for you. Does the general chaos of our national politics have you searching for inner peace? Well, luckily, there's an app for that. Mindfulness and meditation have become big business for tech companies. In an article for The Ringer titled "Meditation in the Time of Disruption," my next guest, journalist Mike Powell, looked at whether it was really possible to unplug and reset while tied to an app on your phone, apps like Headspace or Insight Timer. So how effective are they? Mike Powell joins me now to discuss it. Hi, Mike. Welcome to All of It.
Hey, Allison.
And I want to know from listeners, if you use an app, what works for you? And has meditation affected your life? Give us a call, 212-433-9692, 212-433-WNYC. This show and these segments are for you, everybody, on this election day when everybody's feeling just a little bit stressed out. Mike, what prompted you to take a closer look at meditation apps?
Well, it was funny. I used them in my personal life, but as a writer, honestly, I just sort of felt like I wasn't seeing the coverage that I wanted to see. So sometimes you're in a position where you say, well, maybe I should go out and write that piece to spend a little bit more time looking at these things. I mean, you know, they've been around for several years now in various forms, meditation apps. And obviously before that we had cassettes and, you know, records. And, you know, the idea of a pre-recorded guided meditation is not a new thing. But, yeah, the short answer to your question is I just wanted to spend some more time with them and to have an excuse to call that work.
At least you're honest about the last part. Well, you said you weren't happy with the coverage you've seen of the apps. What questions weren't being answered for you that you went in search of those answers?
I'm not sure if it was about answering questions so much as it was about the tone and the perspective. I think meditation is, for a lot of people, a touchy subject because it's so closely connected for a lot of people to spirituality. And, you know, it just gets into squicky places for people. People are, you know, there's reticence about things that can seem new agey. The apps that are out there are very carefully calibrated, I think, to kind of step around those sorts of resonances for people. New agey stuff doesn't bother everybody, obviously, and some people are maybe not as skeptical as others. But I think that when I was reading about the apps and how mindfulness was being covered and meditation was being covered, I just felt like there was sort of skepticism that was veering into cynicism, and that was kind of a baseline tone. And I thought, well, I'd like to try this a little differently. So that was essentially it.
There are a lot of apps out there. There's Calm, Insight Timer, Simple Habit, and then Headspace, which is sort of, you know, like the Google of them all, the Band-Aid. Everybody knows Headspace. It was launched by an ex-monk who's currently its CEO, Andy Puddicombe. Tell us a little bit about him. His story is really interesting, and then how he founded Headspace.
Yeah, his story is interesting. I mean, he is, and this is the case, I should say, with, you know, a handful of the apps, the people that are involved in either the founding or the co-founding have, you know, real serious backgrounds in Buddhist meditation and, you know, Buddhist thought and meditation more broadly. I mean, Andy Puddicombe is a guy, you can go read about his life. He lived in a cave for a while. You know, he's English. I think his sort of turning point with meditation, I think it came for him during college. He kind of went off into the hills for, you know, 10 years or something like that. So he has a very serious background, was a monk, et cetera, did other interesting things. I think he worked in a circus for a little while as well, unrelated possibly, I'm not sure. But in any case, he founded Headspace with a guy named Rich Pearson, who worked in advertising and is kind of a classic figure. You see a lot of figures sort of like Rich Pearson when you kind of research this stuff. You know, a guy who was essentially a white-collar guy who became seemingly overly burdened by the tasks of his career. So they set out to, develop an app that is framed in a way that's very friendly and pretty secular, and Andy Puddicombe leads these guided meditations, and, you know, they're pitched toward a variety of different emotional states or whatever, if you want to take it from that angle. Do you want to relieve stress? Are you dealing with grief? Are you dealing with, they've got stuff about overeating, they've got stuff about difficulty sleeping, et cetera, et cetera.
We have a little bit of one of the meditations. I want to let people actually hear Andy Puddicombe in action. And this is from,
voice.
Headspace. Yeah. Let's listen.
So sitting comfortably, just taking a big deep breath in through the nose, out through the mouth. As you breathe in, noticing how the body expands. As you breathe out, just watching the body soften as you gently close the eyes. And rather than the mind leading the breath, allow the breath to lead the mind. Notice the sensation of the breath.
Mike, what do you think makes Headspace unique?
Well, I guess I would frame it a little differently.
Okay.
I mean, you know, I appreciate that you played a little bit Andy Puddicombe, because I feel like his appeal is, to me, is fairly immediate. Mm-hmm. I can totally understand why people appreciate not only his teaching, but, you know, for every five words we're firing back and forth, he's saying one. You know, he's good at what he's doing. He's very measured. He's friendly. He's appealing. And the feeling that I had as I was kind of experimenting with Headspace is he's able to pitch his teachings in a way that don't make him feel necessarily like he's teaching you. It's kind of like a good teacher is sort of feels more like a friend at times, or someone who's kind of walking with you on the same path. And I think it's one of the reasons why Headspace has become as successful as it has. I mean, I think people are just comforted by his presence, and the teachings are pretty well calibrated. So in terms of unique, I mean, I think that is unique. It's fairly focused in how it approaches this stuff. You know, other apps have maybe a variety of teachers, with Headspace sort of just him. If you use Headspace, there are a lot of cheerful sort of animations that go along with some of the guided meditations, or I should say they're used as introductions. That sets it apart. It's very well branded, I'll put it that way. However you might feel about that, it's got a presence. So I think that does set it apart.
Let's take a call. Rachel from Jersey City. Hi, Rachel. Do you meditate?
I do. I'm a regular meditator. I never miss. I sit in the morning before the day starts. I'm also a regular practitioner of yoga. And I do all of that because I'm also a full-time working single mom. And so, like, the balance is necessary. It really grew out of necessity. I've brought yoga and meditation to my students, my own children. And I was telling the the producer that I've recently been contracted by a startup whose platform is Digital Detox, sort of this idea of using technology to create space, not to crowd the space. And so I'm actually creating a series of podcasts intended for children between the ages of 5 and 10, guided meditations meant to be done with their caregiver or their parent, as a way to sort of take away the visual stimulation of technology, both for the parent and the child, and try to bring technology to this more quiet place of use where we're trying to teach kids and their adults that it's not all about like more, more, more and like the consumption. And so the podcasts are actually intended to be short between, you know, the meditations are between 5 and 10 minutes each. And I do use online meditation apps. I've used Calm, and more recently I found one or two teachers on Insight Timer that I really love. And in Jersey City, I'm part of a group called Root and Bloom, where there is a local woman. She's sort of like a spiritual guide, and she puts out weekly content, including a guided meditation and a mantra meditation. And chanting is kind of new for me, but I really, really like it. It's sort of transcended me to someplace different when I meditate. So I'm kind of in that space all around. And so I was really interested to hear this segment, and I'm really glad I got to call.
Rachel, we're glad you called as well. Thanks so much. If you want to join the conversation, our number is 212-433-9692, 212-433-WNYC. Are you someone who meditates, believes in meditation? If you have a question about meditation apps, you might want to ask it to our guest. His name is Mike Powell. He's a journalist. His recent article for The Ringer was called Meditation in the Time of Disruption. So let's get to that question of, is this idea of we need to turn away from tech, but what happens when our meditation tools are available through tech? What do you think about that, Mike?
Yeah, I mean, you know, that's the, it's like no one fails to bring up the irony, right? And I think it's worth bringing up, but, you know, that I think the term that you use makes sense to me, which is tool. Like any tool, you can do harm with it and you can do good with it. You know, people, the phone is just a reality. In researching this piece, one of the people I talked to was a man named Joseph Goldstein, who has been teaching meditation, is a really important figure in American Buddhism. He's been teaching meditation for something like 40 years or whatever. You know, and he and I talked about this a little bit. It's sort of what gets people in the door. I mean, people have their phones all the time. It's just it's a useful on-ramp. So I don't know. For me personally, it's like you kind of do have to square that circle. My phone is really useful. It never leaves my pocket. And I use it to sort of help frame my meditation. I'm always happy when I can put it down or throw it away or forget where it is. But, you know, it's like I don't think... Let me put it this way. I don't think that the end goal of like meditating through your phone is that you're somehow just going to surrender your phone and live a smartphone free existence or surrender tech. I mean, this is the world in which we live. And if anything, I think meditation is kind of, if it can do one thing, it can kind of help remind you of the parameters of the world in which you live. So, yeah.
All right. We've got one more call. Vita is calling us from the Lower East Side. Hi, Vita.
Hi. How are you?
I'm well.
I found it very interesting because I was born and raised in India. And, yoga, when you say yoga, it's Ashtanga yoga. So there are eight parts. Ashta means eight and Anga means limbs. So there are eight limbs to yoga, and one of them happens to be meditation. But in, I guess, in the West, yoga is seen as an exercise and, you know, meditation is separated from it. So I think that's a very interesting distinction.
Thank you so much. We've had a couple people mention this app, 10% Happier. A couple people have called in. Was that part of your research, Mike?
Yeah, it was. And in fact, Joseph Goldstein, who I just mentioned a couple minutes ago, has teachings on 10% Happier. 10% Happier was founded in part by Dan Harris, who's an ABC anchor. And he has this kind of like great kind of origin story of how he had a panic attack on air. I think it was about 10 years ago at this point, and that led him to meditation. 10% happier is interesting. It's in between something like Headspace and something like Insight Timer, which was mentioned by one of the callers. You know, there are guided meditations on there. One of the things that I think is interesting about 10% Happier is there are sort of pre-recorded conversations between Dan Harris and people like Joseph Goldstein that I think help contextualize meditation in a way that's really approachable. You're watching two people talk about it, which, I don't know, for me personally, is like it's an easy way to learn things. So that's kind of how 10% Happier is set up. But there are a lot of different teachers on 10% Happier, and yeah, it's definitely one of the bigger, more visible apps.
And finally, we have to say these apps aren't free, right?
Well, I mean, there are different tiers. In fact, like one that I use pretty much every day is really just, it's like an egg timer. I mean, it's called Insight Timer. There are ways in which you can pay for it. There are like guided courses if you want to go that route that you do have to end up paying for. But there are free versions of all these things. And I think that, you know, it's important to remind people that, because I've had conversations mm-hmm. with friends where they say, well, all this stuff costs a fortune. It's like, well, it can. I mean, you can pay for it if you want, but there are sort of basic training wheels versions that are free. And I got the sense from talking to the people that are making these things and working on them that, you know, they're trying to run businesses, so they have to think about money at some point, but they're coming from a place of really wanting people to have a relationship to meditation or trying to spread it. So, short answer, not necessarily.
Okay. We've got one final caller we're going to squeeze in. Gina from Milford, Pennsylvania. Hi, Gina.
Hey, how are you?
Great. How are you doing?
Great. Thank you. So I guess my comments are I'm a sort of on the fence user of these apps. I do think it's a great tool to help people who have no way of exploring being in their bodies and their internal terrain. But I also strongly feel that meditation and yoga has something to do with being in community and elevating that vibration by being with others. And then at the same time, my other comment was, you know, I guess these apps work because the timbre and sound of the voices of the people that are producing them are appealing. There's a certain rhythm. There's a certain vibration. Had this person's voices been a little bit more annoying or a different tone or timbre, then we're vibrational people as humans, and so we wouldn't respond to them as well. So, yeah, that's sort of coming from a Tibetan healing bowl background and a body-based therapy background is what I do for work. These are just sort of my reflections on how I feel about talking to people using these apps.
Gina, thank you so much. This has been a great conversation. Mike Powell, the name of the article is called Meditation in the Time of Disruption. Mike, thanks for joining us on All of It.
Hey, thanks for having me. Take care.
Coming up next on All of It, we know the news can make you sick, but what about the ways you consume the news? We'll hear from the author of a piece, You Are the Media You Eat, and we'll take your calls. I'm Allison Stewart. All of It will be back after a break. Welcome back. You're listening to All of It. Thank you so much for joining us. Today on All of It, we've been talking about our brains and our bodies and the beating they've been taking during this run-up to the midterms. You know, you can't take hearing another word about Democratic socialists or white suburban voters, but you still cannot turn away from Twitter or CNN or BuzzFeed. We're joined now by Farish Yaqob. He's the co-founder of the creative consultancy firm Genius Steals, and he wrote a series of articles on Medium earlier this year for making the case for a balanced media diet. Farish, thanks for joining us.
Thanks for having me.
Listeners, we want to hear about your personal media consumption strategy. What types of media do you seek out? President Company excluded. Give us a call, 212-433-9692, 212-433-WNYC. Do you seek out multiple sources for information? Do you give new outlets a shot? Do you decide to just shut down because you don't think it's any good for you? Just give us a call, 212-433-WNYC. Okay, Varys, you titled the first part of your series on a balanced media diet, You Are the Media You Eat. What does that mean?
Yes. So it means sort of literally that, in the sense that we believe that ideas are new combinations, that nothing comes from nothing, that you are the sum of your sources. So at a sort of very functional level, the way you think is a function of the things you put into your head. And on a sort of more day-to-day basis, the way you feel increasingly is a function of what you consume every day.
So in the way that you put food into your body is how mm-hmm. your body's going to run, how well it's going to run or how not well it's going to run. Same thing
Absolutely.
With media.
And the same thing is, yeah, that's sort of the idea that the analog, the sort of heart of the pyramid, which is that how we use our mind moment to moment largely determines the kind of person we become, and that we're changing all the time, and that we can adapt how we feel based on the media we eat. And that's why I decided to use the classic American food pyramid as a structure for the recommendation, because people recognize it and sort of intuitively understand what it means. The shape is very simple and the structure is really clear, which is that there's a finite amount of calories that you consume or should consume in a day, and there's also a certain amount of media we consume every day. Most recent data is that from Nielsen, etc., suggests that we consume about on average in America 12 hours of media every day.
What?
Which is a huge amount. Sort of split between majority mobile and digital and television, with sort of the rest filling in the rest of the pieces. But that's a huge amount of time, right? So that's a vast amount of time to give over our brains to somebody else's inputs. And similarly with the pyramid, there's lots of research that suggests some media makes us feel better and some makes us feel worse, particularly if we consume it in large quantities. And some, I would argue, is toxic entirely at the very top of the pyramid. Yeah.
All right, let's talk about the pyramid. Let's break it down. Of course, we all know they've moved to a plate now, but we all grew up
yes.
with the food pyramid.
My plate, yes.
Yes. At the top, you have media that brokers in falsehoods.
Yes. So I didn't use the my plate because no one's really heard of it. The pyramid had bedded in far more effectively. And also, it's not as clear. The whole point of the pyramid is that at the top is smaller, at the bottom is bigger, and that should represent how your diet is allocated. But yes, so I think in the second and third versions, I put it in as InfoWars and Goop and the Mail Online as being essentially brokers of toxic falsehoods, by which I mean something that's nominally not fiction, which represents things they know to be untrue, primarily for ideological or commercial reasons. Selling you snake oil or trying to incentivize political animus based on falsehoods is inherently bad. Like, having your brain full of lies means your model of the world is wrong, broken, and all probably designed to make you angry or sell you things you don't need. So that's just bad for you.
And so you move down the pyramid, and we talk about, I think in the food pyramid, it's you should use sparingly.
Yes.
What's sparingly in media?
So it depends on how you want to think about it, right? The 12 hours is where I started, because even that thought is very surprising to people, because it's so much time of your day. Like, when do you sleep? When do you work? When do you use the restroom? And probably using your phone in the restroom nowadays, but you know, and maybe while you eat and work as well. But sparingly, I'd say, if you think about it in half-hour increments, like half-hour portions, you have 12 half-hour portions, 24 half-hour portions per average consumer day. So a half hour to an hour a day seems good. There's a lot of research that suggests digital media consumption tends to peak in terms of satisfaction and psychological well-being at about 2 hours a day. Beyond 2 hours a day of kind of social media consumption or news, streaming news, you tend to feel less good. And that sort of makes sense if you think about it. There's a couple of reasons why that I think across the whole pyramid, right? The more active you are in what you're choosing to watch and put into your head, the more you tend to report feeling better, right? So if you're consuming somebody else's algorithmic stream or the broadcast stream on the news, you're not making any decisions about what you're seeing. And that tends to make you feel less like an active participant in the world. And therefore you feel less agency, less mm-hmm. control, which makes you feel worse about yourself and the world often. But that said, before that, there's some quite good aspects to it. You know, I consume way too much Twitter, for example. That's one of the things that I was trying to rebalance when I wrote this for myself, you know?
What is nutrient-rich media? Let's say, what's at the bottom of right. the pyramid, that thing that they say you should definitely have intake?
Yeah, absolutely. So what makes you feel better, and what can research show us makes you feel, what makes you either feel or perform more smart, more empathically, more friendly? So there's a number of things, right? And they all tend to be in the areas that are slowest, most sort of high culture, which comes with certain, you know, political and cultural prejudices baked into it. But things like the theater and art galleries and reading books and going to museums all tend to make you feel better afterwards, not worse. And they have some evidence that make you smarter. That sort of makes obvious sense in a way, because things like going to museums and reading books are sort of education as well as being media, and that tends to make you feel better in general. One of the most important ones, and it's not really a medium, but I had to get it in there because it's so important, is that it's socializing with actual people, talking to humans, like we're speaking now, right?
Yes.
This is a much more valuable experience for me now than it would have been if I was just listening to this on the radio, because I'm sort of involved in it and I get to, you know, express myself and hear someone else's points of view.
Let's go to Ari on line two. He's calling from Wayne, New Jersey. Hi, Ari.
Thank you for taking my call.
Sure. You went cold turkey?
Off all internet news, yes.
Wow. What prompted that?
Well, I'm in graduate school. I'm working hard on my dissertation, and it's a very computer-heavy dissertation, and I found that all forms of news media online were, to me, incredibly addictive and incredibly time-wasting. So I actually found a service that I pay for quarterly. I think I pay about $35 or $39 a quarter, that will actually allow you to block any category of website on your computer, including news, but also social media, video game sites, any type of thing like that. And I found it to be incredibly... Oh, and then to disable it, you really have to go through a very lengthy process to get rid of it. It takes at least half an hour. So I found it to be incredibly liberating. I found that I waste a lot less time. And I'm still up to date on things. I listen to the radio in the car. I drive for work, drive for school. I recommend anyone try it, at least.
That's really interesting. Ari, thank you for checking in. It's interesting that Ari said he just got rid of it all, because you write in your article that we're sort of hardwired to want information.
Yes, I absolutely think we are. It's one of the most valuable things, if you can imagine, a pre-internet world where information was scarce. Information is hugely valuable because you can both keep it and give it away and generate social currency that way. I think people tend to hit this backlash point. In the last few years of doing talks, the number of people who report in the audience trying some form of digital detox has gone from zero to mostly in the last 5 years. Mm-hmm. And I think that's because people realize, yes, that these things have addictive qualities. In fact, you're talking about, you know, algorithmically designed social media platforms, Facebook, Twitter, etc. They're specifically designed to keep you engaged, which means keep you on the platform, which means keep generating more media time to sell ads around. And what engages tends to be the most arousing and or divisive pieces of content.
And negative. So, we have a negativity bias, right?
Absolutely do, yeah. Because we tend to be hardwired to focus on things that are upsetting or potentially scary or dangerous, because if you think about it again in a sort of state of nature, we're driven by two compulsions: the need to get rewards in order to eat and procreate and so forth, and the need to not die. And ultimately, the need to not die overrules the need to get the rewards. So negativity bias makes sense that way.
With about 30 seconds left, someone listening to this, what advice would you give them so that they can have a productive media consumption experience?
I think with general is, if you start to feel anxious, don't think that looking at the news more will make you feel less anxious. It'll make you feel worse. That sort of addictive behavior in general. But also just allocate your own attention with intention. Don't let how you spend your day be dictated to you by other people, be it media companies or anyone else. Like, be conscious of what you're consuming, because it's going to change who you are.
Be mindful. Faraz Yaacob is from the creative consultancy Genius Steals. The name of the three-part series, it's definitely worth a read. You are the media you eat. Faraz, thank you so much for joining us in all of it.
Thanks for having me. It's a pleasure.
We'll be right back after the news.
This is Ira Flatto, host of Science Friday. For over 30 years, the Science Friday team has been reporting high-quality science and technology news, making science fun for curious people by covering everything from the outer reaches of space to the rapidly changing world of AI to the tiniest microbes in our bodies. Audiences trust our show because they know we're driven by a mission to inform and serve listeners first and foremost with important news they won't get anywhere else. And our sponsors benefit from that halo effect. For more information on becoming a sponsor, visit sponsorship.wnyc.org.